Hello and welcome to The Progress Theory, where we discuss scientific principles for optimizing human performance. I am Dr. Phil Price, and on today's episode, we are joined by a roundtable of researchers in forensic psychiatry. We have Jill Colangelo, Dr. Alexander Smith, and Professor Michael Lee Brenz, all who are researchers in forensic psychiatry from the University of Bern. Now, if you take the whole population, we know that a very small subset of that probably have psychopathic traits. Now, if we took that subset, not from the whole population, but from certain environments or professions, such as surgeons or CEOs, we start to see that they have a higher prevalence of psychopathic traits. What about elite sport? How prevalent is psychopathy in elite sport? So that's why we brought this roundtable together, so we learn a bit more around psychopathy. What are the pros and cons of psychopathy in certain environments? And how can we identify if we have psychopathic traits? As always, follow The Progress Theory on Instagram and YouTube. Check out all of our content. This is quite a serious discussion. So if you feel that you have been affected by any of these topics in this discussion, please check out our show notes because we have several links there which can help. Here is psychopathy in elite sport. Are you a hybrid athlete who wants to learn more about how to combine your strength and endurance training? Well, I've written a new book, The Science of Hybrid Training. In this book, I provide insight into the misconceptions surrounding strength and endurance training by distilling the past 50 years of research and drawing on the conversations I had with great scientists, coaches, and athletes on the Progress Theory podcast. This book is essential reading for hybrid athletes and coaches who are looking to understand the key training variables and their effect on the simultaneous development of strength and endurance performance. Get your copy now, available to buy from Amazon. Now, let's get into the show. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming on to The Progress Theory.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, like I said, just to start the recording, this is certainly a first for the podcast. You know, we haven't had a group. Thank you, Jill, for suggesting getting Alex and Michael on board with this because, you know, this is a perfect opportunity to discuss something that I feel that is certainly misunderstood and not really talked about that much. And I'm no psychiatrist, psychologist. This isn't my area. So this is going to be a great learning curve for me. But before we go and discuss what we wanted to discuss regarding elite sport, did you want to introduce yourselves? I know you work at the University of Bern, but do you want to give a little bit more depth as to your work?
We do. I think the best way to do that is let's start with Michael, since he is Professor Dr. Michael Lee Brenz. He's the head of our department. So he can maybe just give you a quick line about who he is. It's probably, you know, it's less technical of me to call him the big boss, but he'll explain a little bit more about who he is.
It's always difficult to react to so much niceness and kindness in an introduction. It's very difficult for me to pick up on this, but I would consider myself the big boss. Just trying to have a creative team around me. I'm very thankful to have Jill and Alex with me on this call. And we are trying to drive the specific subject of sports psychiatry and sports psychology forward. We have quite some different projects within the team, which we are working on. But back to my person, well, my name is Michael Ebrens, and I'm heading the department actually of forensic psychiatry at the University of Bern. But we do have the possibility to engage sometimes in subjects that are a little bit different or interdisciplinary in their approach. And one of them is sports psychiatry and sports psychology. The background for this is that, of course, there's a lot of regulation involved, for example, anti-doping regulation. And this is something that brings us closer to the law. And this is exactly where we are working on at the intersection of medicine, psychiatry, and the law. And that's why we as a department can have an interest in this or provide research data on this sort of subject. Alex?
Thanks for having us, Phil. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm a senior researcher in Michael's department here. I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, so my background is in the humanities and social sciences, but I'm very interested in how psychiatry and mental health interact with culture more generally, and obviously that includes sport as a significant cultural touchstone. So that's my interest in the mental health side of sport, but also, yeah, we've got a lot of projects ongoing to do with the kind of regulation and regulatory frameworks that's around sport.
Excellent.
And Jill?
So finally, I'm just a researcher in sports psychiatry, primarily at the university. My background is in psychology. I'm also a former ultra endurance athlete myself. And like we enjoy saying around is, you know, research is me search. So I started off interested in this stuff because of experiences that I had. And it led me to doing research on mental health in ultra endurance athletes specifically. And then that kind of branched out into mental health in general among all different types of athletes. I actually feel really lucky to be working with Alex and Michael on this because it has really advanced what my research area is. And it, I think, has really helped sort of form a broader idea around the types of advocacy that we're hoping to put forth in the area of sports psychiatry and sports psychology.
Oh, amazing. It sounds like a very well-rounded group. Like everyone's not in the same area. You come from different, slight different backgrounds to investigate sort of mental health in various different ways. Do you find that, especially when developing projects, that's really beneficial because you've got lots of different backgrounds providing ideas to the group?
That's absolutely something of our strength. And it's this really small niche subject, if you want to call it that, although everybody does sport somehow, right? But it's a niche subject. And so it's really difficult to find someone collaborating partners and people who are driving the field forward with the same sort of energy. And so I'm really grateful for having Jill and Alex. And this is an international collaboration, as you can see, with a variety of sometimes even other universities involved. So it's really a great endeavor.
No, certainly. Hopefully I'll come up with some interesting questions to really challenge the ideas that you've got. Could we start off just providing a bit of background? Because I know we wanted to talk about psychopathy in sport. And what was great when I reached out, you suggested doing this call after the Olympics, and hopefully there's some great examples that have happened at the Olympics that we can sort of like touch on. But before going into that, what is psychopathy? Because I think it's something that seems to be quite misunderstood, and some of it might have reached social media, and as soon as something reaches social media, it gets kind of lost because people are trying to utilize that information to benefit them in some way. So yeah, what is psychopathy?
We'll defer to the forensic psychiatrist and the clinician on this call, and Michael can give a perfect definition.
Again, about perfect, this is another question. And especially with my lack of capability of the English language. So, but I'm going to try and please add on, Alex and Jill, if I didn't get this across correctly. So the thing is that, yes, indeed, the term psychopath, or that is something that is often used in popular culture. Indeed, it is a personality pathology. And the traits are associated with some different things like lack of empathy, narcissism, manipulation of others, coldness and disdain for authority, rules breaking, something like this. And usually what's expected is that folks like this are something that you can easily detect. It's not like that. It is something that they can appear very charming and they are very contagious. First, what we got to say, it is both things, just traits that someone can exhibit, and it is not personality disorder as such. So disorders are then, if you reach a certain level, then you can come to a clinical diagnosis of these traits, and then you would say, all right, this is something that can be diagnosed, and it's then more than a simple observation. So if you want to say you have personality disorder, which affects around 3 to 5%, like an antisocial personality disorder, then you have around 1% of the general population that also exhibit these psychopathic characteristics. So again, we have to make a differentiation between the traits and the personality disorder, which is then a clinical diagnosis. And when we are talking today, we will probably talk about the traits and not coming to the conclusion of giving an armchair diagnosis, how we would call it.
Yeah, I agree. I think also just to say that it's very sort of conceptually debated. So you can often, there's a lot of literature about the sort of definitions and proposals around the traits that are and aren't psychopathic and the extent to which they are and aren't. And that is interdisciplinary, that argument. So it's kind of like psychology involves psychiatry, involves social sciences. So yeah, there's a lot of conceptual debate around it. But I think that was a really good overview, actually, Michael, based on the literature. So
can I ask what the main differences are between the antisocial disorder and someone with a psychopathy. If you've got 3 to 5% being more antisocial behavior, and then you've got like 1% is psychopathy, what are the key things that differentiate the two?
It's a subgroup of the antisocial personality disorder. If you then are, again, if we are not talking about the general population where we can see traits of this, but we are looking then at the clinical diagnosis, then we have people who are antisocial personality disorder. And within this group, there are people who are then fulfilling the criteria for psychopathy. That means that not all antisocial people are people with an antisocial personality disorder are very charming. So maybe a good example would be that someone who has an antisocial personality disorder, which is often associated with criminality, it is something like that would be a person that would steal from an elderly lady the handbag, which is rip it from her hands, right? As an example. And someone who has an antisocial personality disorder with psychopathic traits, psychopath, he would actually make the grandmother give him the handbag and the grandmother would feel good about it. There's quite a distinction, but both exhibit a coldness and a lack of empathy. But then those who are having these specific traits can be very charming.
Mm. That's an excellent analogy. I've just got this image of a grandmother having their bag stolen and just someone like convincing them. I've often heard that those that often have psychopathic traits lead into, I've heard that they're quite common in surgeons, they're quite common in CEOs, people that reach the top of big businesses. And I guess, I don't know if it's because certain things that they have to do, they find easier, like you know, cutthroat decisions at the top. Is that actually true? And I guess that's why I wanted to link it to elite athletes, because, you know, there's such a small subsection of the population, elite athletes, because not many people can reach that level and then do these traits actually follow them as well.
Yes, so I think we have to be careful in two things. We are not talking about then full-blown personality disorders, because they are also then attached with the question of functionality or dysfunction in a variety of social contexts. But yes, it is true. There are investigations that show that in the top leadership of financial industry, but also of academics, we do have a higher majority of these traits, because some of these fields are very attractive in the sense that they play to the narcissism aspect, and they also are very advantageous if someone has the capability of implementing rules that apply for others, but then the person himself or herself doesn't want to follow those rules. That's something that is easily manageable. And then, of course, being very convincing, being very charming, having the capability of engaging and building up networks, that's something which is very important in these areas. And then, of course, which is then the difference between someone who's just a charming and nice person, breaking off the relationships as soon as they are not advantageous for someone else, using someone as a stepping stone, finding out what the person needs, playing basically a character for this person in order to manipulating the other person into giving him what is required by the person who exhibits those traits. It's always very hurtful for this other person who then feels exploited. And we see this in studies that people, even after years of being exploited by someone who exhibits psychopathic traits, still tries to rationalize this relationship and still tries to see the positives in something which is so disadvantageous for the person himself.
Something that might sort of be interesting to think about is that while we are talking about some traits that may have certain advantages for, let's say, a CEO or even an athlete, if a person is exhibiting traits that are associated with psychopathy, there is no ability to sort of cherry pick and say, well, I'm just going to exhibit the ones that are positive. Once a person is exhibiting any of those traits associated with psychopathy, they will be engaging with the spectrum of positives and negatives associated with those traits. So that kind of, let's say, tenaciousness that we might associate with someone being a successful CEO or a successful athlete, I think we often think of, you know, the very disciplined person who doesn't take no for an answer and all this stuff. We think that that's great, right? And that's maybe a good side of one of these traits. But with that is going to come other things, like, for example, leading into the dark spectrum of things like abuse or things like, you know, a relentlessness in pursuit of something that could be hurtful or harmful to themselves or other people. it is not possible to remand oneself to one side of that spectrum or the other. The person is going to, for better or for worse, exhibit the full complement of all the things associated with that trait.
That leads sometimes to this aspect that is reported that psychopaths do not fear emotions or fear or sadness or love. Are they even capable of doing this? But in fact, they experience emotions, but their way of responding and experiencing them is just greatly different from the norm. There is evidence that many psychopaths may have reduced anxiety responses, for example, which then contributes to them making riskier decisions or having less concern about the negative consequences of their behavior.
Okay. Just to follow on your point, Jill, because when we look at, say, elite athletes, we kind of judge them by their performance in the sport. We don't often see their performance or their social circle around the sport. So everyone judges the positive bits because those positive bits seem to affect the bits that they see. And so is it very common that someone might be performing really well and they get adored for performing really well, but underneath that, they've got all those negative traits which might have contributed them to getting to that point, but to them, they don't really care because that point of, I don't know, winning Olympic gold is the point that they're trying to get, and whoever they hurt on the way, they don't really care about.
Yeah, that is definitely true. And unfortunately, that is the truth more often than we want to think, is that an uncomfortable reality of sports and excelling in sports can sometimes be these sort of other detrimental factors that we're not really interested in talking about. And I just want to point out here, because if I don't, Alex is going to whack me later, but it's really important that we understand there is actual law about the idea that we cannot look at an athlete, even if we've seen them perform a million times, we've seen them on different games, we've seen them speak on podcasts or in interviews, and we think we really know these people, and we've seen their what we think of as their traits. We cannot look at that person and diagnose them by what we are appreciating with our eyes or what we are watching or what we think we're gathering from media. And there's actually, like I said, there's laws set up against doing this. But for the purposes of the discussion, right, so the skills and attributes that we appreciate when we see an athlete who is really at the top of their game. If we think that those things exist in a vacuum and they are only happening there on the playing field, we are really incorrect. Because a lot of those attributes that have gotten that person to that place have, by definition, negative consequences that can, not in all cases, but can and will bleed out into other aspects of their lives. This is one of the reasons why we have a department, right? And then we're talking about sports psychiatry because we are talking about the idea of someone's mental status as they enter into the sport. What are the things necessary for them to be who they are in this world and then be an athlete? So if you've got someone who by nature exhibits these characteristics, right, we have to leave space for what that does to them as a person and not just what that does for them as an athlete. So that's really kind of where it all comes together.
And what does it do to the social context, the social fabric they are having? And again, sports is so multi-layered and multifaceted. It doesn't just affect the people who are the athletes themselves, but could be the coach. So you have people who are coaches and exhibit these traits. Imagine if they are being exposed to athletes usually at a very young age, what kind of detrimental effects this has on the mental well-being of those who are trusting in them and have little life experience at this point, just purely by the age.
There is research on obviously psychopathy in other occupational domains, and that was one of the reasons that led us to sport, you know, based on the things that we previously discussed. But I just wanted to flag, because it is probably of interest to listeners, that there's a very famous paper by Scott Lilienfeld, unfortunately deceased now, but he basically examined psychopathic traits in the office of the US presidency in historical presidents. Fearless dominance was especially associated with positive job performance in terms of leadership and persuasiveness. Antisocial traits were unassociated with presidential performance, but were also linked to some aspects of negative job performance. And that's like one of the very salient studies of psychopathy in occupational domains. Obviously, the office of the US presidency, there's kind of no more consequential office. So I think it's just worth flagging that as a very influential paper in the field that kind of led us down this path.
Also, branching off of what Michael was saying is that it is the coaching, you know, can be the coach-athlete dynamic. It can be, believe it or not, there's research on the interaction between the actual athletes on the playing field and the people in the stands and how their actions influence each other and their behavior. And we also have to think about what happens when you have an athlete who exhibits these type of traits and they show disregard for, let's say, norms or conventionalities of how we interact with each other. Person who's a quote unquote rule breaker, right? We love that. Someone who breaks the rules. Wow, isn't that great? Yeah, that also makes them someone who's likely to be a dober, right? That's somebody who doesn't feel that they have any reason why they wouldn't use performance enhancing drug. And so as you heard Michael describe at the beginning of this, you know, we do, a lot of the work we do is interacting with law. And therefore, it is an important point that the type of person who is willing to cheat, like that is a specific type of person. And if they're exhibiting that, they're able to do that, then they're exhibiting the types of traits associated with psychopathy. That is someone that we've brought into the sport because isn't it great? They have all these other traits that made them a great athlete, but it also led to them thinking, having no scruples, right? And just thinking like, why not? I'll just dope. And ruining themselves, the sport. We've seen these people historically, right? And in some ways, we all pay the price for that as spectators, as athletes ourselves. And sometimes those experiences can really taint a sport. I don't think I need to talk too much about cycling, right? Which there's still, as we've talked about, there's still a specter hanging over cycling for certain people's actions and doping to the extreme, you know, even over a decade ago. So these things really do affect us and they affect society and sport in general, which is why it's really important to put it in context and really understand where the negativity lies.
Has there been any specific research which have retrospectively done some analysis on the athletes that have been caught doping and found they had very similar personality traits almost linked to psychopathy?
So that would likely fall under that umbrella of research that we cannot do because by law, those people would not be patients of ours unless one of us, Michael specifically, was treating those particular athletes. He would not be able to speak on those athletes, nor would any of us, just based on privacy violations, right? The laws are abundant and that would not allow for that type of discourse to take place. It is an interesting question, though, and I think it's one that is important to sort of think about, even just anecdotally, where are those people now? What kind of experiences are they having in their lives? What is the public perception of those people? And again, going back to cycling and thinking about one person in particular who has been banned from so many different sports because of the reputation that they have, we can see that their actions do make life difficult for themselves. And it's not just professional, but it's personal as well. But that's, again, that's just conjecture and it's anecdotal, but it is an interesting question.
So there are some folks who would be willing to go out there and diagnose certain people. Again, this sort of armchair diagnosis, which is constitutes a violation of our work ethics. But then again, there is, in how would someone like this be identified? In criminal proceedings, for example, it is quite possible that a state attorney or a judge orders the mental examination of a person, and then he would be seen by a psychiatrist and or psychologist, depending on the jurisdiction. In that case, all the relevant data would be available, and then there could be a formal diagnosis, which then, of course, could be told in front of the judge and the court. Breaking the rules in these circumstances is, of course, something that could then go into, or could be feeding data in one of those evaluations. But again, you would also look at the relationships in the private context. Is this person someone who leaves the family or is mistreating his children? Is the rule breaking just limited to the sport or to any other things? Is there a lack of remorse? How does this person stand to the crimes the individual has committed? Does he show any remorse? Or does he say, well, this is their own fault? Why were they so trustworthy? They could have exposed me. These sort of things play a role into this. But then again, to talk about sports, there are some aspects of this personality, which are in this body environment, something that maybe even specifically looked for or searched for. Because if you look at it, right, this notion that you have to participate in a race, maybe downhill skiing, or a skier ahead of you is having a terrible accident, and you are going next, or you're seeing him on the track, and human emotional reaction would be to say, oh, yeah, stop, I'm just going to go down there, and I'm going to try to help this person, or, you know, how is this person going? But actually, the notion of the spectator, the expectation of the coaches is you have to block everything out. So the human aspect of what makes us human beings has to be put to the side, and that's the expectation, and you have to put a best side there. And of course, someone can block this out and has a lack of, has less empathy. It may be more advantageous in this very specific scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then of course, the lack of empathy will also be in maybe showing in dealings with the other people in his environment. So that's the issue.
That also leads on nicely to a point that we made in the paper about media portrayals of these traits in sport, that they tend to be kind of bad boy image and like glamorized as sort of anti-heroes to an extent. I mean, if you remember the ex-England footballer Stuart Pearce, whose nickname was Psycho, for example, in the 90s and early 80s and 90s. One of the things that is interesting that we did it after the Olympics, I mean, the three of us certainly picked up on it, was the Nike campaign, which was Am I a Bad Person? And they ran this campaign, and it was basically Willem Dafoe who was doing the voiceover. And they were talking, he was saying some of the exact words that are associated with this concept. So it was like, I show no empathy. Am I a bad person? Overlaid with images of athletes. So quite often these traits are kind of glamorized. And again, that perpetuates a misunderstanding about the detrimental effects for the individual, but also those around them. And as Jill rightly said, society at large and sport at large.
Do you think that bad boy image actually plays into the narcissism? It's like they like that.
It's a difficult question.
That's a tough question.
Is that too vague?
No, I think what you're asking is there a glamorization? Like, do people enjoy to see other people behaving badly? Is that sort of what you're asking?
Not from like other people. I can see why people might see that almost attractive, because I don't know, the bad boy image, they associated with that, they see performance and that's what they like. Oh, I can might be able to sort of not copy, but there are sort of traits that they have, which I feel like if I had them, it might lead to an improved performance for myself. But I think my original question was more around, I know narcissism is quite high and those with psychopathy. So do they go towards sports which have more attention on them or more money, which feeds into that? And then when they get there, they get this image of being a bad boy. And then that just, they like that. That plays into the narcissism.
Yes. It does it. That's the point. So it's not just, this is what makes these high positions attractive. And again, it's not just in sports, but it's also in business. The little control, this aspect of showing dominance, of having power over other people, of having power over other destinies. And then, of course, being in the public and having all this attention is something that plays very well into this. And the notion is that you can keep this facade most likely for a long time. And even if proven otherwise, still keeping this and suing everybody else. That is something very particular and which is associated with this sort of traits, yes. Mm. And the other point you are making now, is this something that spectators are being drawn to? It might as well. I'm not an expert on that aspect, but of course, maybe the ruthlessness people that are, you know, not having in their own life, maybe they are looking for this in this situation and cheering for that. But I think it's more this portrayal within, and this is no media bashing, but the portrayal within the media of these traits being something to aspire to is the notion, right? The guy pushing someone else away, not kneeling down, not the camaraderie. It's focusing on the wins, the most medals, the most success, and not on the notion of camaraderie, which is great in sports, right? Stopping your bike, helping someone else, looking back, turning over, waiting if someone else has an accident and not writing an attack at that moment. So there are actually things which the media focuses more, and maybe they start to do this and shifting, the next generation is shifting more into this direction. Then I think also this positiveness of psychopathic traits will disappear and will make it more at what it is something that is not good for the common people. It's not good for us in sports. It's actually not something we really want to see. We want to see the positive side of it.
I think the Nike campaign is a perfect example, because I would urge people to go away and look that up, because there's a specific thing when it's like, I have a lack of empathy. Am I a bad person? And I can't remember what it's either a free throw that goes into the basketball hoop, or it's someone who finishes first. And it's basically directly connecting a lack of empathy with sporting success. A lack of empathy is indicative of these traits. And if you think about how a lack of empathy could actually play out, and the negative consequences of a lack of empathy, like Michael said, with the downhill skiing, where you just ignore an opponent who's potentially very seriously injured, it ignores a whole bigger picture and perpetuates kind of misinformation about the seriousness and the gravity of actually what these traits can do.
I would also like to add to that, that although we're talking about elite athletes and we're talking about the Olympics, and these types of traits can and are exhibited by just regular amateur athletes, and the way that we can see those traits is, let's say, on a much more micro level, but let's say, for example, let's take narcissism. You know, we're imagining this person coming out like onto, I don't know, a tennis court or a, you know, football pitch, and they're just eating up all the adoration from the crowd, right? And it's feeding this sense of narcissism. An amateur athlete who has a, you know, very strong narcissistic trait is someone who will miss every one of their kids' birthdays to train. It's someone who will not show up to family holidays or anything like that, because their need and what they want is more important than anyone around them. And so when we sort of, as a society, allow for the glorification or the glamorization of these traits, the elite athletes, for example, that spot, and it is so disturbing, that spot. It really is. I cannot emphasize enough how you expect it to sort of turn back or to kind of take its foot off the gas, you know, at some point, saying, well, I feel like a bad person, but actually sportsmanship is the way to go, you know?
Yeah, especially with the Olympics.
Yeah.
Olympic spirit, you know?
Yeah, because we expect, like, you know, we uphold athletes as heroes in our society. And with that should be some measure of kindness and empathy and some of the better, you know, our better selves, right, as they say. But that's not the case with this ad. It is disturbing. And once we start to glorify and glamorize these traits in the elite athletes, that trickles down to amateur athletes. It trickles down to the youth. It trickles down in a way societally that somehow now gives permission for people to behave badly in order to achieve what they want. And specifically when we talk about making time for lots of different things in life and having different obligations, you know, it really starts to become very uncomfortable, even within like a family dynamic, when there's one person who is now sucking all the attention and energy because, you know, they are participating in a sport that's taking up a lot of their time. So these things, they seem kind of out there and kind of like, oh, well, this is happening on the world stage. You know, this is happening at the Olympics. No, this is happening at your local triathlon. This is happening at your local, you know, half marathon. It's happening everywhere. So it's important to not underestimate, let's say, the power of these messages, where they come from and where they end up.
Do you think this needs to change? Are we heading further than that direction, glorifying that? And really, the media needs to do a bit of a U-turn. Otherwise, it could lead to dangerous situations. And that might be one for you, Alex, from like a culture point of view.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a juxtaposition, isn't it? And this is why, not to keep returning to this Nike ad, but I was just so surprised about it. Because on the one hand, you have all of this increasing sort of mental health awareness in society in general, and especially in the British press, more sensitivity towards mental health, towards psychological issues, towards psychiatric issues in the press. You even see that, you know, sometimes obviously the Daily Mail will reveal itself once again, but quite often it's spoken about in a more sensitive way, and athletes are being, you know, who have been diagnosed with a mental health issue or a mental health disorder are using their platform to speak openly about it and to kind of dispel myths around it. So that you've got that on the one hand, and then on the other hand, like this, as I said, this advert that is talking about all of these traits unconditionally associating them with positive sporting success. I felt very uneasy about that as we sit here. I felt like we'd left a lot of this discourse behind, but obviously not. And like Jill said, I mean, I was expecting the ad to change, like at the end, to be like, oh yes, I am a bad person, and actually I've rediscovered, like, you know, yeah, sportsmanship and stuff, but it doesn't.
Yeah, kind of touching also this question of the results, and if the media glorifies this, this is an issue. On the other hand, we have to say that even like in podcasts like this, if we try to sensitize society for this, and this is actually a strategy that is even applied in this question of treatability, because we as physicians, then if you have a clear-cut diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder with psychopathetic traits, it's really difficult to treat this sort of person, because he himself or she himself herself is not suffering under this. It's usually the environment which is suffering. So what the emphasis is to try to educate, to raise awareness and to protect those who may be victims of this behavior and of these sort of individuals. And that's something why I think, and what the media can do, you know, not glorifying this, but actually mitigating against the negative effects of people they might be associating with or being exposed to unknowingly, who are exhibiting this sort of behavior, and they are constantly wondering why this relationship turns so foul.
And that, again, that comes back to, you know, why we first got into sports psychiatry in terms of the regulatory angle, because as we call for in the paper, there's a lot that sporting associations could do in terms of no tolerance to abuse, in terms of more rigid rules around these things to protect the sport and to protect the rest of the athletes as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Do those with these traits recognize that they have these traits? I'm assuming things happen to the environment around them because they aren't really aware of these traits because they're so focused on what they want. Does that make it even more difficult?
Depends on the introspection and self-insight of the individual. So I wouldn't say this is a binary. You can't answer this binary. But I think the majority is aware of their capability of manipulating others. That's a conscious choice. Imagine folks who have super antennas for what the other person might need. So they also don't select their victims by chance. They're looking for specific, not just weaknesses, but they kind of play the person this other one needs or is in need of. That's a conscious decision, because there is a decision and a causal reason for behaving like this in order to gain an advantage. The advantage can be something as simple as having a great relationship with the officer or the person who's handing out the parking allowance in your company, because having this great relationship gets you a better parking spot. But if this person is falling sick or so, it's not going to be, you know, I don't care. This manipulation can be really subtle, and it can be in this needed in order to gain an advantage. But the foundation is that there is never, or there's very rarely, a real interest in the other person or the relationship itself. It's designed to gain an advantage, and it's dropped when it's in this relationship is being dropped when it's not for the advantage anymore. And this may be the manager, the coach, the wife, children.
I'm going to interrupt here because I wanted to share with you the Progress Theory newsletter. If you want the latest information and recommendations on how to optimize your physical and mental performance, then subscribe to the free Progress Theory newsletter on Substack today. Click the link in the show notes and subscribe to get the best information on human performance sent straight to your email. Now, back to the podcast. I've noticed over the last few years, especially with technology getting better and also more people are speaking out, are we going to hear more stories about certain individuals, do you think? Let's say sport, but it could be from a variety of different walks of life, but that have not, I don't want to use the exposed, but you know, there's been a number of people where, you know, you've seen them perform and you think, oh, this person's great. Then all of a sudden, loads of people come forward about how poorly they've been treated in the past by this person. I'm trying to avoid being like that, like you said, that chair type of, oh, that person, yeah, must have those types of traits. But do you think that's going to happen more because those that have those traits have got to a certain point, but now people are more open to speaking out about people who leverage that to get to where they get to?
From just a general perspective, I don't know that people are well-versed enough about the traits associated with psychopathy to make a judgment call on, you know, well, this person is acting in a way that is, you know, they're acting in Machiavellian or they're acting narcissistic. Or I don't think that people are commonly aware of those things. What I do think they're aware of, though, and what I do think is a good thing, is that our tolerance for people behaving badly is going down. And we are now understanding the boundaries of what we are willing to withstand in terms of abuse or poor behavior from other people. And there's more people willing to stand up and say, I was hurt by this person. I was abused by this person. I was compromised by my coach, my team, the team doctor, right? We've heard this before. We're hopefully in a place where nor the athletes nor anyone else affected by the behavior of someone who is perhaps in this category should feel afraid to stand up and say something and advocate for themselves. So from that perspective, I think, to answer your question, I think we're going to see more of the evidence of those traits, but I wouldn't say that the public would be educated enough in these particular nuances to know, well, this is a trait that is manifesting itself like this. You know, I think we're going to see the manifestations of those traits.
I would have expected this to be happening already a little sooner, because the advances in the field over the last 15 years of psychopathy, or 20 years, have been pretty strong in a variety of levels. And also, the concept is not brand new, right? I mean, this is something which was already done in the 60s, 70s. It is, for me, very surprising that there is not more knowledge in the general population about this. However, I think this is also part of the aspect that it is so charming to interact with these individuals that people generally think, oh, this can't be true. This is not how I envision it. And if we go back to the study that Alex was citing on the psychopathic traits in presidents and the correlation with success, he might want to pull it up and read which are the ones with the highest scores, like later in the, and you might be surprised. And maybe we can even ask him, Phil, to guess who's number 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then he can come and Alex can then compare it to the study, because you might be surprised, but maybe now after already learning something about this concept, and you might be speaking of armchair, but this would be legal because now we are doing it, comparing it to a study. Then you can give your own estimation and we can compare it and just have this as a little riddle.
So I have to guess the American president, which I believe had, what, they got voted that they
exhibits the most psychopathic traits. Yes.
Yeah. Because you can imagine people, the first thing they're going to think of is Trump.
He wasn't on there.
It wasn't on there. Oh, is it from a few years ago?
Yeah, so it's presidents up to and including George Bush. And it was a study from 2012. And it's a really interesting study, like I said earlier. So they basically asked historians to rate psychopathic traits and then compared it to job performance, specifically with fearless dominance. And the first one's not so famous, but the second one's very famous. A very famous US president.
I think the word you want to think of, Phil, is you want to think about the way that this kind of manifests, and the word that we haven't really used yet, but it's so important because it is the thing that draws us to these people. And, you know, we've talked about sort of like that charming aspect. The word is charisma, right? And it is not, it is usually, when you find the word charisma, it's not too far a leap to get to somebody who is exhibiting these traits, someone who embodies these traits. And so when we think of those charismatic leaders, right, which, as we've seen historically, can go sideways really quick, right? We think of somebody who really has the ability to draw people toward them, right? To get people on their side, to have people see things the way they do. So hopefully that can kind of help you conceptualize
Sure.
who might be.
Okay. So the person that actually comes to mind when you say charisma, because I've heard of a lot of reports saying that he was incredibly charismatic, is Bill Clinton.
7.
Oh, 7.
The first one you probably won't get.
I'm aiming for that number 2 when you said he's very famous.
But Phil, this is the exact thinking. So you're right there.
You're not 7 out of 10, you're 7 out of
7 out of 42.
Alex, I can't remember the list, but JFK has to be on there somewhere, right?
That's the one. Second.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
I'll just do it. So yeah, it's Teddy Roosevelt, JFK, Franklin Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, Rutherford B. Hayes, Zachary Taylor, and Bill Clinton, Martin Van Buren, Andrew Jackson, and then George W. Bush as the top 10.
Okay. That's interesting you said really linked it to charisma, because that wasn't really where my mind was going. My mind was going towards risk-taking to the point where it might actually be negative. So my mind went Nixon because of what he was caught doing. As soon as you said charisma, that completely changed my thinking. I said Clinton because I guess I'm more familiar with it based on age. But then I think of charisma comes sometimes with popularity. So my second one was JFK, just because I knew he was a popular president. So it's interesting that, yeah, he was number two.
Yeah, your charismatic leaders, those are your team captains. You know, if you're in America, that's the prom king. That's often the person who really just is like a shining star, which is why it's so difficult to be in a relationship with a person who everyone knows as this amazing talent and just what a wonderful person. And then you only know them to be an abusive monster, right? And so this is where that kind of inability to see someone for who they are, it's really tough. It's really, really hard to step away from that, to think like, well, this is the public persona of this person. They're amazing. But then behind closed doors, like I said, that's where we recognize, again, the spectrum, the negative and the positive. So yeah, it can be really tricky. It's a really tricky thing to deal with, for sure.
Yeah.
And again, not all prom queens or kings are people who have just to point this out. It's a spectrum exhibited. They don't need to have a diagnosis and they don't need to be violent or criminal to have this, right? For the listeners, for the audience, right? Not everybody we are mentioning, or not everybody we are mentioning, but if we are bringing in these examples, it doesn't mean that everybody has this, but there is a higher chance in someone like this than in someone who is always sitting in the back corner and having a hard time engaging with others and being very isolated and to exhibit this sort of trait.
Mm.
It's also important to say that just exactly the flip side of that is true. So not every really fantastic athlete is fantastic because they are like murderous in their intent in terms of their discipline and that they don't have limits or are not rule followers. That's not the case. We're not saying that everyone who's a great athlete, like we should be looking at them sideways, like, oh, well, what's wrong with you? How did you get this good? That's not the case at all either. So both sides are true.
And what did you say, Michael? The prevalence is about 1% in the general population, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, but then already for the full diagnosis, right? So for
that's full, full
diagnosis, not for traits. Traits are obviously more evenly distributed because this advantageous for the entire society. Why do we have this then in our society? Well, they are genetic traits and you can immediately see if someone is charismatic, if he has charm, the superficial charm, that is something that can be given further and can enter into the next generation very easily. So it's not, it has these really difficult problems associated with it for the entire society, but for an individual, it may be advantageous. But again, for the majority of those who are having a full-blown diagnosis, it is also something that ends up in a prison environment. And that's why this concept was originally synthesized in this environment, where they were suddenly aware of offenders who exhibited not just the dissocial traits, but on top of them were really manipulative and charming. Too. These are the ones then, for example, who sometimes you hear that in the news being reported that a correctional officer was fleeing with the inmate or was having a relationship with the inmate. That is something that is usually being then done by individuals who are then manipulating the prison staff because they are exhibiting these traits.
Wow. Well, this talk has completely changed how I view elite performance, you know, the idea around the psychopathic traits. This has been absolutely amazing. I know the listeners will love it as well. I'm definitely going to be putting that paper in the show notes and on YouTube so people can find it and look at it in a little more detail. But if anyone has any other questions or want to learn a little bit more about this, where can they turn to?
not for self-promotion, but I think we did a nice job of a review paper on psychopathic traits in sport, which basically summarizes the existing literature that's out there. And we can send you the link to that.
Oh,
and that's just, yeah, it's got basically, I think, 100 citations in the reference list. So I think that's a good place to start. We've kind of done the hard work in terms of collating all the evidence. So
yeah.
Yeah.
And Michael, do you have any suggestion folks who are maybe concerned about someone they're in a relationship with or may need some additional resources or information? Where can they go?
I think first, that's a really nice question, Jill. And I really think it's really important for the listeners if they are now identifying suddenly, oh, there's something that may be wrong. Again, it's not a diagnosis, but look for these sort of things, get more educated about it. And I think if you do use the YouTube and all this kind of stuff, there are people who are really eloquent about educating about the awareness for these sort of traits and how you can then behave if you are in such an abusive relationship. But again, I wouldn't, because of the countries are so different and the expectations are so different and the possibilities of support are so different, I couldn't comment. But I think first get educated about this and try to figure out. And individuals who exhibit these traits have the unique impossibility of making the victim or the person affected and feeling as if it's their fault or as if they are misbehaving or if they are provoking this sort of sometimes even physical violence towards them. So first get ready that it's not you and have a look about how does this person I'm involved with behave in other relationships? How was the past? How was he behaving in other relationship. So if you are the fifth girlfriend and the four before you were talking about that they were being exposed to physical violence, it's a very high chance that this is not going to be going away with you.
No, certainly. But so any links that you can provide that can help with this, I will certainly put them in the show notes. The example you just provided is quite a serious situation. So if we can help in any way, we certainly can.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, all of you. That was absolutely incredible. I know I'm going to come away from this with a load more questions, so you never know. I may be contacting you in the future to potentially do a round two, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course.
We're happy to talk anytime. We have a lot of work on a lot of different topics. We, I will say, do tend to not take the popular view on a lot of things when it comes to sports psychiatry. We're happy to talk about any of these things, so they might make a little more of a left turn than what people are thinking about. So we're happy anytime to chat.
Yeah, perfect. Forgets people thinking. That's what we want, so... Yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, yeah.
Before we wrap up, I want to give a shout out and my thanks to my production partner, Cult Media. If you are thinking of launching a podcast or want to grow your audience, head to www.cult.media, that's cult with a K, to get started today.